It has been said that Alexander Graham Bell was not the first person to invent the telephone, but the last. If you're nerdy enough, you might know that there was a media and legal battle between Bell and a fellow 19th century engineer, Elisha Gray, who filed his patent for a very similar device to Bell's telephone on the very same day in 1876 that Bell filed his patent. Each of them accused each other of stealing each other's designs, and the courts ruled in Bell's favor without commenting on what they thought Gray had done. But a bit lesser known is how neither Bell nor Gray were the first person to claim they had invented a telephone. Before Bell and Gray, devices very similar to the ones the two of them said they invented were invented by the American Amos Dolbear in 1865, Germany's Philip Reis in 1861, and the Italian Antonio Mucci in 1857. Designs for a working telephone had been written about in enough detail to get a patent, but not built, by a number of scientists even earlier. The Frenchman Charles Boussole in 1854, another Italian, Innocenzo Manzetti, in 1843, and possibly the first, though we can't be sure, an American physicist named Charles Grafton Page, in 1840. By the time Bell built his telephone, he could have used it to call all the other top electroacoustics researchers in the world and tell them about his invention. Bell's hometown of Brantford, Ontario, erected a gigantic neoclassical monument to him in 1917, but at that point, with the debates over the invention still in living memory, the purpose of the monument wasn't to commemorate that Alexander Graham Bell had invented the telephone, it was to commemorate that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, as opposed to all those other rabble-rousers. If you are nerdy enough to know about Elisha Gray, and you are, because you're watching this channel, it's also probably well known to you that Thomas Edison was both an extremely skilled inventor in his own right, and also literally stole some of his most famous inventions, some of them from his one-time assistant Nikola Tesla, one of the original great Aspies of history. This is not the situation with Bell. There's no evidence he knew anything about any of the other attempts at designing the same machine. He probably really did invent the telephone, all on his own, and so did Elisha Gray, and so did Amos Dolbear, Philip Reis, Antonio Mucci, and plenty of others. In the story of human progress, simultaneous invention is a well-established phenomenon. It's rare for one solitary genius to come up with an invention that at least a few other people weren't coincidentally working on at the same time. Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz invented calculus at exactly the same time, and neither of their work was derivative. Most major inventions are like that. The social, economic, and technological conditions are just right, and it happens. This is true as far back as you want to go in human history. Over the course of a few thousand years, which isn't too long relative to how long humans have been around, agriculture began independently in 11 different places on 5 different continents, often with people cultivating the same types of crops and the same types of animals in similar ways, with nobody aware that other people had discovered how to do the same things thousands of miles away. Everybody knows what happens next.
More food and more people who came to buy the food. Now you need people to help make the food and keep track of the sales. And now you need houses for people to live in and people to make the houses. And now there's more people and they invent things, which makes things better. And more people come and there's more farming and more people to make more things for more people. And now there's business, money, writing, laws, power, society.
But let's backtrack and focus on one of those inventions in particular, writing. Like any good invention, writing was independently developed in a few different places, at more or less the same time in history. Most archaeologists say writing was first invented in 4 places, the 4 most advanced agricultural societies at the time: China, Mesopotamia, Central America, and Egypt. There's a little bit of debate over whether Egypt really did independently invent writing, because unlike the other places, Egypt and Mesopotamia are pretty close together, and there were people who had traveled between them. And while that's all interesting, it's pretty much irrelevant to the story at hand. What we do know is this. At least three societies, probably the three best developed civilizations on the planet at the time, invented writing from whole cloth. For a while, all known systems of writing on Earth evolved from those three, or possibly four, systems. Ever since, there have been a handful of cases in which someone from an illiterate society creates their own writing system without knowing any existing script before. The most famous example is definitely the Cherokee genius Sequoia, yes, the namesake of those trees, who invented his own Cherokee language script in the early 19th century. An Alaskan Yupik man named Oyakuk invented a script to write the Yupik language around 1900. But in all those cases, the creator had had contact with literate people and knew at least how the concept of writing worked. If you look at Sequoia's Cherokee script, you'll notice that a lot of the letters look a lot like letters in the Western alphabet, even though they make different sounds and represent entire syllables. Clearly, Sequoia knew what written English looked like, even though he couldn't read it. But in between the invention of the original three or maybe four scripts and the present day, there may be one true case of a society that didn't have writing and didn't have contact with anyone who did, coming up with their own alphabet. And it happened in perhaps the most unlikely place possible, Easter Island. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. I like doing episodes about tiny, isolated, obscure little places nobody has heard of. But this episode is about a tiny, isolated, obscure little place everybody has heard of. For an island 1,289 miles from the nearest other land, and 2,000 miles from the nearest continental land, which is Chile, which administratively Easter Island is a part of, for an island that may have never had a population over 10,000, Easter Island looms surprisingly large in the Western imagination. In part, that's because of the Moai statues, the hundreds of giant stone human heads that loom large across the island. They're so iconic, there's an emoji of them, one of the very few emojis for individual, specific monuments. But Easter Island is memorable in other contexts, too. And it might be a household name even without the Moai. There's a dwarf planet out past Neptune called Makemake, named after the supreme deity of Easter Island mythology. The immunosuppressive drug rapamycin, which makes most organ transplants possible, and might even work as a cancer treatment, is made from bacteria found on Easter Island, and it's named after the island's native name, Rapa Nui, which was also the name of a 1994 Hollywood epic co-produced by Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner about the Marx meets Tolkien class conflict on the island pre-colonization between the so-called long-eared elites and short-eared commoners, a story now believed to have originated from a mistranslation of the island's traditional legends. The movie Rapa Nui, now has the main legacy of being one of the least successful films of all time in terms of the ratio between how much it cost to make and how much it made at the box office. Also depicted in the movie Rapa Nui is a garbled version of a story that many people believe really did happen. The destruction of the island's last trees. Supposedly, Easter Island was once covered in lush palm forests. But by the 1600s, the native population, by all accounts an advanced agricultural society with a strong social hierarchy, had reached such numbers that they had to cut down all the trees on the island, leading to ecological collapse followed by famines, cannibalism, and the eventual reduction of the island's population to a tiny fraction of what it once was. Jared Diamond, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, considers it the clearest example in human history of an environmentally driven population collapse. My middle school science textbook used the collapse of Easter Island to illustrate the concept of a tragedy of the commons. But, as popular as it is, we can't be sure this really happened. Something terrible happened in Easter Island's past, that we know. But at least partially because of that, we don't know as much as we think we do about Easter Island. Prior to the collapse, whatever may have caused it, the Rapa Nui people were doing pretty well for such a tiny society in such a remote place. They had agriculture covering most of the island, a varied diet, and elaborate social and religious rituals, which weren't limited to building moai. Every spring, the island held what is best described as the world's most intense egg hunt. The island's strongest swimmers would go out to a particular rock through ice-cold, shark-infested waters, retrieve an egg from the sooty terns that nested out there, and swim back with the egg intact. Each swimmer was sponsored by a man of high standing, and being the sponsor whose swimmer brought the first egg back conferred a sort of royal status on that sponsor until the next year's egg race. The island received its common Western name when the first European arrived on Easter Sunday, so it's only a coincidence that the island called Easter Island is also the only place in the world where a large element of the culture and possibly the most important annual tradition was once a death-defying egg hunt. They were clearly a very complex society, and like any complex society, they had writing. Or did they? There are 26 known surviving examples of Easter Island's script, and some archaeologists say it's more like 15, as some of them are questionably authentic. They consist of rows of symbols, some resembling plants or animals, others more abstract, carved into wood, probably using shark teeth as styluses. Present-day Easter Islanders refer to the script as Rongo Rongo, which means to recite or announce in the Rapa Nui language, but it's not known if that was what it was called when Rongo Rongo was in widespread use. The cultural memory of Easter Islanders regarding Rongo Rongo seems to agree on a handful of things. First, Rongo Rongo was used to keep a few different types of records, including annals of Rapa Nui history and lists of people who died in war. Second, that the official records were carved on wood, but students learning Rongo Rongo used banana leaves, which have all rotted away by now. And nobody has been able to read Rongo Rongo in centuries. Beyond that, everything is conjecture. The first white person to visit Easter Island was the Dutch sailor Jacob Roggeveen on Easter Sunday of 1722. Roggeveen's diaries don't describe coming across any writing, but they do seem to contradict the ecological collapse narrative. Describing an island that is indeed treeless, but mostly under cultivation, home to an estimated population of several thousand, mostly tall, healthy people. Pollen analysis suggests Easter Island's last palm trees vanished around 1650, so the islanders could have had time to recover from a breakdown of society between then and Roggeveen's arrival, But that's not really what the people promoting the Easter Island collapse theory are alleging. The collapse comes later. It was 48 years more until more Europeans came to the island. A pair of Spanish ships in 1770. They mapped the coastline, marveled at the many standing moai, built three crosses on a hilltop, and then left after 5 days, at which point the crosses were unceremoniously dismantled by the natives as the Spaniards sailed away. While they were there, they signed a treaty annexing the islands for the Spanish crown. A handful of chiefs, not really sure what was going on, signed it with what a later historian described as certain characters in their own form of script. Most of the so-called signatures are indecipherable scribbles that don't look like Rongo Rongo characters or any other form of writing. What they do look like is what would happen if the Spanish had scribbled out some signatures of the people on the ships on the treaty and then offered the treaty and the quill to the chiefs with the clear intention that they would do the same, so they bemusedly also scribbled on it. But there on the treaty, next to the scribbles, is an unmistakable Rongo Rongo glyph. Just one. It looks like a standing bird, possibly a pelican. It's also been speculated that it could be a person or a sea turtle. Whatever it is, it and characters like it appear all over the surviving Rongo Rongo texts. While some wooden Rongo Rongo tablets are speculated to be older, because they seem to have been cut from big trees, which weren't present on the island after the mid-17th century, the Spanish treaty in 1770 is the earliest clearly dated appearance of Rongo Rongo. The next foreign visitor to Easter Island was Britain's famous Captain Cook in 1774, and he had a distinctly different impression of the place. He was aware of the Moai statues from Roggeveen and the Spaniards' accounts, but he found that in the few years since the last European visited the island, almost all the Moai had been toppled. The Spaniards definitely hadn't done that. They specifically noted that they were impressed by the Moai, even though they did seem to be heathen idols, and besides, it would have taken lots of people a lot of time to knock down all the hundreds of gigantic Moai on the island. For some reason, over less than 4 years, the Rapa Nui people had become extremely determined to destroy all the Moai. The reason why this happened has never been fully explained, but today, most of the standing Moai have been restored for tourists. Almost all of the Moai bear damage from this strange episode. What's more, Captain Cook found that most of the island looked like it had been covered by farming at some point, but most of the fields were now unattended and overgrown. He estimated that the population numbered barely more than a few hundred, and didn't say anything about them using writing. Over the next century, most European assessments of Easter Island agree with Cook. It was a sickly and declining place. I'm more inclined to believe that the collapse of Easter Island was because of internal conflicts among the Rapa Nui people, which according to oral tradition, have definitely been a thing a few times in the island's pre-colonization history. Introduced diseases from Roggeveen sailors probably would have contributed as well. The picture that these accounts of Easter Island paint is weirder. It's not that the islanders thrived as a civilization, then destroyed the environment, and collapsed. It's that they destroyed the environment, then thrived as a civilization, then, in the half-century interval between the first and second European visits to the island, something happened that caused them to collapse. Something that probably had religious and/or revolutionary significance because of the destruction of the Moai. But it took until 1864, almost a century after the Spanish treaty, for a Westerner to bring up Rongo Rongo again. And by then, Easter Island was a miserable place. Smallpox and tuberculosis were sweeping through the remaining native population, which might imply that neither of them reached the island before. That would further complicate the reasons for the 18th century collapse, because otherwise the narrative of newly introduced European diseases causing conflict and religious upheaval makes sense. But if the 1860s on Easter Island weren't bad enough because of sickness, Peruvian slave raiders would regularly kidnap people on the island en masse. Amid this chaos, a French Catholic missionary, Eugène Hérault, figured that times of crisis are good for evangelism and went to live on Easter Island for 9 months, successfully converting most of the surviving islanders and, sadly, putting an end to the death-defying egg hunt ritual. Hérault wrote that in nearly every house on the island, there were wooden tablets and sticks engraved with what he called hieroglyphic characters. Some women wore bark cloth skirts with similar symbols on them. Nobody he met knew how to read them. The islanders didn't think much of the tablets, and mostly kept them around as decoration. Over the next few years, missionaries multiplied on Easter Island, and some took an interest in Rongo Rongo. Unfortunately, it became clear that the window for finding Rongo Rongo texts had quickly, decisively slammed shut, right around the time Hérault lived there. By 1868, a few years after Hérault's time on the island, there were almost no tablets left. A Rapa Nui elder reported that he knew people who had been able to read and write Rongo Rongo, but they had all been killed by disease or taken away to Peru. Now the tablets were worthless, and they were falling out of favor even as decoration. Hundreds were destroyed as firewood or as planks for canoes. Some were found in graves, but they were too rotted to be legible. In 1914, British anthropologist Catherine Rutledge tracked down two islanders who claimed to be the last people on Earth with some knowledge of Rongo Rongo, but their claims contradicted each other, from which Rutledge drew the interesting conclusion that Rongo Rongo must not have had one established meaning. Rather, each scribe back in the glory days of Easter Island had their own personal Rongo Rongo. People would usually only be trained in one scribe's use of the Rongo Rongo characters and wouldn't be able to read most other forms of Rongo Rongo. But this is just a hypothesis, a Rongo Rongo hypothesis, and it hasn't stopped others from attempting to decipher the Rongo Rongo text that we do have. There has been one remarkable success. In the 50s, German ethnologist Thomas Bartel, who worked as a cryptographer for the Nazis during the war, identified one as a lunar calendar, a conclusion that has been widely accepted by others working on Rongo Rongo. How he arrived at this conclusion isn't incompatible with Rutledge's theory that there were many Rongo Rongos. Bartel noticed that in one tablet, a character similar to a crescent moon appeared regularly spaced throughout the text, 29 times, 28 days, plus a leap day in the already understood Easter Island lunar calendar. From there, he managed to tell that a fish-like character preceding the moon glyph sometimes had its head pointing upward and sometimes pointing downward in a way that corresponded to the waxing and waning of the moon. Most days in a 28-day month had unique names in the islanders' lunar calendar, but there was a run of 6 days early in the month that didn't have individual names, and sure enough, on the tablet Barthel examined, there were a few distinct characters between each moon glyph that weren't there where those 6 days would be. Jacques Guy, a French linguist in Australia, elaborated on Bartel's discovery. This was clearly a lunar calendar, but since it had an extra day, it was an explanation of where to insert a leap day. This interpretation fit with the descriptions of the waxing and waning of the moon, and today, the tablet is generally recognized to mean, if the moon starts looking like this at this part of the month, it's time to add in a leap day at the end of the month. Unfortunately, this discovery hasn't led to the deciphering of any other Rongo Rongo texts, most of which use different characters, And Rutledge's hypothesis that the same characters meant different things depending on the scribe that was making the tablet is widely believed. The other promising but unconfirmed attempt at deciphering Rongo Rongo was made by the Russian linguists Nikolai Butenov and Yuri Norozov in 1957. And here's a photo of part-time Bond villain Yuri Norozov. He was an extremely important figure in the little corner of linguistics devoted to deciphering ancient languages. His research on the script of the Mayans eventually led to it being successfully deciphered, so he should be taken as seriously as he looks. Norozov speculated that one very repetitive sequence of Rongo Rongo, in which one character is repeated every three spaces, and the character before it always has a long penis-like appendage on it. I said penis-like for a reason. I'm getting there. He thought that was a genealogy. Norozov thought that the repeated character signified that the characters after it were a name, and the penis-like symbol means fathered, which is understandable, I think. So he thought it had to be read as person's name A, fathered person's name B, fathered person's name C, and so on, possibly as a record of chiefs on the island. If this is true, it means that a lot of other tablets are easier to decipher as well. Some of the other tablets use the penis thing, and other linguists have tried to interpret these texts as creation myths, based on a literal interpretation of what the characters look like. Things along the lines of, the birds diddled the fish and produced the sun. The angry god diddled the round thing and produced the nightshade plant. The man diddled the shark and produced another shark, which, men, I hate to break it to you, that's not what will happen if you try that. But going off the interpretation that it's a genealogy, it makes a lot more sense, because most of those difficult to decipher images would be people's names. If that interpretation is true, then the vast majority of Rongo Rongo texts are genealogies. And if that's true, then to what extent is Rongo Rongo really a script? If the other things we can be sure were written with Rongo Rongo are simple, almost mathematical texts like calendars and genealogies, was it ever possible to write a story using Rongo Rongo? Most linguists say no. The idea of Rongo Rongo being a complete form of writing has fallen out of favor over time. The common consensus is basically that it's just a series of mnemonics, with only a few common factors in between different scribes' use of the symbols. One of the key reasons why people are skeptical of Rongo Rongo as an independent script is because of how rare an independent invention of writing is. Proto-writing, some marks that serve as mnemonics, is a far more common invention. As I've said before, there are only three confirmed cases of people with no previous knowledge of writing coming up with the idea of it. This has led some to speculate that Rongo Rongo was in fact inspired by the 1770 signing of the Spanish Treaty, which would have put the idea of writing in the islanders' heads, but that's usually rejected because it would have to mean Rongo Rongo was invented, came into widespread use, and then pretty much entirely got forgotten over just a few generations. But what if I told you instead that Rongo Rongo may not have been an independent invention after all? That some people on Easter Island, pre-colonization, may have been aware of other forms of writing. In my Akali Raft episode, I talked briefly about the Norwegian anthropologist and adventurer, Thor Heyerdahl. Heyerdahl's big thing, which he did multiple times, was building rafts using ancient materials and sailing thousands of miles to prove that there could have been contact between ancient peoples across oceans. But Heyerdahl's role in the Akali Raft story is tangential. His role in the history of Easter Island is acute. The most famous thing Heyerdahl ever did, by far, was to sail a handmade boat called the Kon-Tiki from Peru 5,000 miles through the Pacific to French Polynesia. His journey, made in 1947, was meant to draw attention to his theory that Polynesia, and Easter Island in particular, could have been settled by South Americans. He believed that Easter Island was once home to two separate ethnic groups, one clearly Polynesian in origin, the other one from the Americas. They intermarried, but also saw each other as separate peoples. The main thing Heyerdahl based this theory on was the same ancient story that Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner based their movie Rapa Nui on. It's time to finally, really talk about the long-eared and the short-eared people. Rapa Nui legends are unambiguous. Long ago, before the Europeans came, there were two peoples on Easter Island, locked in a rigid caste system, the Hanaoepe and the Hanaomomoko. Most historical sources translate this as long-eared and short-eared people, which I guess paints a picture of ancient Easter Island as an endearingly shitty circa 2012 teen dystopian Hunger Games ripoff, maybe airing on the CW. In a world where people are divided based on the length of their ears, a pampered, long-eared girl falls in love with a dashing, short-eared revolutionary bent on tearing down the system so that the short-eared can rule. Oh wait, that's already a movie. It's called Rapa Nui, and it's co-produced by Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner. Also, the long-eared and short-eared thing is probably a mistranslation. Hanaoepe was probably intended to mean stocky people, and Hanaomomoko, skinny people, which makes a lot more sense as a description of the differences between them. Some say one group was already living on the island when the other one arrived, but which one was there first varies depending on the teller. Supposedly, they lived together in harmony for a while, but that all changed when the Hanaoepe attacked. They wanted to dominate and enslave the Hanaomomoko, and the Hanaomomoko fought back, eventually gruesomely killing all of the Hanaoepe. The Hanaoepe's last stand took place when they retreated to a corner of the island, dug a ditch, and filled it with charcoal, setting it ablaze and using it as a fiery moat. But the Hanaomomoko found their way around it and attacked from behind, pushing the Hanaoepe into their blazing ditch. To this day, that part of the island is called Kote Umo Ote Hanaoepe, or the Oven of the Hanaoepe, which is also very grim stuff, but most anthropologists doubt it ever really happened. The consensus on the Hanaoepe is that, yes, at some point, there was a major conflict on the island, and maybe it did involve some poor unfortunate souls being barbecued alive. But the idea of the Hanaoepe as a distinctly different people who fell victim to the victorious Hanaomomoko has pretty much been rejected out of hand. But Heyerdahl didn't. He thought that the Hanaomomoko, that is, the surviving Easter Islanders at the time of colonization, were ethnically Polynesian, while the Hanaoepe had been ethnically South American. There were other details, Heyerdahl thought, that pointed to a South American origin for some people on Easter Island. A rock off the eastern coast of Easter Island has always been called Motu Motira Hiva, or Island on the Way to Hiva. Hiva is a place name used in many Polynesian languages to mean the semi-mythical original homeland of Polynesians, but Motu Motira Hiva isn't on the way to where the Polynesians came from. In the conventional narrative, people arrived from islands to the west. Motu Motira Hiva is in the exact opposite direction from the rest of Polynesia. The only thing this island on the way to Hiva is on the way to is South America. So the Rapa Nui people must have believed they came from there. Heyerdahl also points to Jakob Roggeveen's diaries from his original visit to Easter Island in 1722, in which he describes a distinct split between short, dark-skinned residents with Polynesian features, and taller, lighter-skinned residents with features he couldn't exactly place. And then, Heyerdahl pointed out, Something happened in the 48 years between Roggeveen's visit and the next European visit that caused Easter Island's population and living standards to decline, and nobody after him mentioned seeing anyone non-Polynesian looking on the island. Oh, and the people of Easter Island had a written language, or at least something a lot like it. No other Polynesian society is believed to have had anything like writing at the time. But you know who did? You know what place is one of the three or possibly four true origin points of writing? Central America. It's conceivable that people living along the west coast of today's South America, hundreds of years ago, were vaguely aware that the people to their north had a way of visually conveying words. And maybe, Sequoia style, someone remembered that concept years later, on a remote island, thousands of miles from their people's homeland. Even though Heyerdahl's journey successfully proved that South Americans could have made it to Easter Island, he didn't prove that they did. And for most of his life, his theory was rejected by most anthropologists. It was a stretch. Yes, they acknowledged there were a few weird aspects to Easter Island culture, but what he was proposing didn't meet Occam's razor. In 1960, when Heyerdahl was all the rage in popular science media, the American anthropologist Robert Carl Suggs compared his theories about Easter Island to other crackpot pseudo-archaeological nonsense like Atlantis. In the intervening years, though, a few people have grown more open-minded about the prospect of Heyerdahl being right, but they were still a minority until very recently. At the dawn of DNA testing, some sequences were taken from indigenous Rapa Nui people that suggested most of them had some South American ancestry. But that was mostly dismissed as having come more recently, possibly as a genetic scar of Peruvian slave raids. They also had some European blood for the same reason, and nobody seriously suggests there was contact between Easter Island and Europe before 1722. Until July 2020, when a paper was published in Nature explaining how this couldn't have been the source of the South American ancestry. They had examined the genes of 100 indigenous Easter Island residents and found that all of them included genetic traces of an indigenous group in modern-day Colombia. This was the first conclusive evidence of ancient contact between Polynesia and the Americas. This isn't quite proof that the Hano Epe Hano Momoko story is true, though. The scientists behind the 2020 study speculate that the initial contact and intermarrying between Colombians and Polynesians occurred on a different Polynesian island prior to anyone settling Easter Island. After all, as one of the most remote islands on the planet, Easter Island is also one of the most recently settled places in the world. It's believed that there were no humans on it before 1200 CE, meaning that Oxford University and human habitation on Easter Island are about the same age. What the authors of the 2020 study believe happened is that Easter Island was settled by the mixed descendants of the Polynesians and Colombians, some of whom may have looked very different from each other, as biracial ethnic groups often do. This successfully squares the obviously Polynesian elements of Easter Island's language and culture with their mythology of having arrived from a land far off to the east. This means a lot for the decipherment of Rongo Rongo. It means that there really could be a link from the Mayan script to Rongo Rongo, because the Mayan script really was a complete writing system. It would have been a stretch, possible but not plausible, to suggest what Heyerdahl did, that people down in what's now Chile had some knowledge of Mayan script. But if the South American ancestors of the Rapa Nui people were from modern-day Colombia, it makes much more sense. There was trade along the Pacific coast of Central America, if these ancient Columbians were skilled enough seafarers to make their way all the way to Polynesia, of course they knew about the written language being used right next door to them. So, Rongo Rongo may be a true script after all. It was discovered in a 2010 study, which mostly flew under the radar, that the frequency of different characters in Rongo Rongo script obeys most of the laws common to natural languages. If it was just a mnemonic for keeping track of dates and lineages, it wouldn't necessarily fit those rules. It's also been noted that three different Rongo Rongo texts, ones that don't clearly fit the predictable calendar or genealogy structure, all begin with the same first line of characters. Could this be something like Once Upon a Time? There's still a lot we don't know about Easter Island. Rongo Rongo is just one of the many interlinked questions surrounding the place. But there may yet be hope.
Thank you.